I had been texted last night by county council that there was a planned search of my house, maybe as early as 7 a.m. So I thought, okay, that's what it is. So, put on some clothes, went downstairs, opened the door, and I have never seen so many deputies all in one place. And they said, stay inside, stay inside. And I said, no, you don't have any dominion over me. I'm coming outside.
LA County Supervisor Sheila Kuhl, hours after the Sheriff's Department deputies raided her home yesterday morning, the Sheriff's Department said the raid was tied to an investigation into a county contract awarded to a nonprofit run by a friend of Sheila Kuhl's. That friend, Patty Giggins, is also a member of the Sheriff Civilian Oversight Commission, a group that oversees the Sheriff's Department and has clashed repeatedly with Sheriff Alex Villanueva for his refusal to comply with subpoenas. Both Kuhl and Giggins have called for the removal of Sheriff Alex Villanueva. He is up for re-election in November. For his part, Villanueva said he has no knowledge of this raid, and he recused himself from the investigation. We're going to talk about this now with Supervisor Kuhl. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Good to be here and all by myself in my house for a change.
Yeah. And you don't have your own phone. You don't have your own computer. They seized everything.
Everything. Three computers and two phones. So I have no email. And I have a loaner phone from the county that, you know, I can get texts. So I don't know that anyone feels sorry when you're cut off from all these electronics. Maybe people wish they could be too. But it is incredibly disconcerting to have people take all your, you know, it's like my personal database over 80 years is in my personal computer. And there's nothing in there about Metro in anything, really.
Okay, so you brought up Metro. So this is the accusation that an employee said she was retaliated against by Metro for bringing up this issue that the organization run by your friend Patty Giggins got this no-bid contract for, I guess, around $800,000. Is that right, to run a sexual harassment hotline?
You know, I have no idea what the amount was. And that was, I think, over several years. Peace Over Violence is the preeminent national organization that deals with sexual assault and domestic violence. Peace Over Violence was asked to monitor every bus and every train. Imagine how many that is a day. And to take calls on their hotline, to post signs in the buses and trains, if you're being sexually harassed, call. And this disaffected employee who has since left Metro has alleged that there weren't that many calls. Well, that's not the point of a hotline. The point of a hotline is you're there when someone needs you. This disaffected employee who she said she was paid off, but actually she was bought out because everyone at Metro wanted to get rid of her. She has been a troubling and troubled person for a long time. So rather than, you know, go through the whole Michigas, they bought her out, which I heard later. There was no connection between me and this contract. And the sheriff, I believe, who is friends with this disaffected employee and her husband, has been drumming this up for years to try to get back at me and Patty. Patty is not only a member of the Oversight Commission, she was the first chair. And she was elected by her peers to go on after her first year. So they set up all the ways in which, as we hoped, there would be oversight of the sheriff. But as you indicated, he has never cooperated. And he's the one subject to a federal investigation, not any of us.
But just let me ask you, optically, does it not look a little bit suspicious that a close friend of a county supervisor gets the no-bid contract for $800,000, even if it is the premier organization in this field?
No, I don't think so at all, because I have been working in the domestic violence movement since the 70s. So if I have a close friend who's in the area of sexual assault and running a premier organization, you could see everybody else is contracted with her as well. I didn't have to do anything, and indeed never even knew about it. The administration at Metro looked at all the organizations, chose Peace Over Violence to do their sexual harassment work, and it never came to the Metro Board. The sheriff seized their server yesterday. So now they're not even able to serve the women who are calling in for help.
So talk about this raid then. So how did it come about now? I understand that you were actually tipped off that it was going to happen. You didn't know exactly when, but that you would be raided. Is that standard procedure?
To raid someone's house when you are investigating, which only you don't have a real investigation open? No.
Well, no, that wasn't the question, but we can get to that. No, just in terms of how the raid went down, you were warned about it, and so you were prepared in some ways.
I don't know where the tip came from. I mean, I was told by county council they had been tipped. I can't think of anywhere it would come from but the sheriff's office. So mm-hmm. he's the one that should investigate himself. And, you know, okay. this ridiculous notion that he's recused from it when he said, I thought rather drunkenly last night, if you saw the interview, I think on Fox 11.
On Fox.
And when he said, oh, I get regular reports about it.
My undersheriff, Tim Murakami, is the one that provides leadership to the public corruption unit. They did their entire investigation. They made all decisions and ran the decisions through him. I had no involvement whatsoever. They gave me an update periodically.
Yeah, he said that your explanation sounded like ex-President Trump's explanation after he was raided at Mar-a-Lago.
Well, you know, if anybody had gone to the effort that Merrick Garland went to before asking for permission to go in, it would have been more legal. There's no facts. I mean, you can read online what they said in order to get permission to search from this judge, who's a friend of one of the investigators in the sheriff's office. He wasn't even supposed to issue any search warrants because there is a designated judge in the court every day that's supposed to issue search warrants. But this guy in the sheriff's department always goes to his friend, who is generally referred to as the dog poop judge, because in years past, he assaulted one of his neighbors over dog poop. I don't know whether your listeners would like to Google that, but it's really fun.
Yeah, I've read that you know, story. It's
several people think that there should be a filing about this judge with the Judicial Performance Commission.
Okay, so this judge, who is a friend of one of the investigators in the sheriff's department, okays this search warrant based on what you're saying is non-existent flimsy evidence. What do you think the real reason
is? There's no evidence, and there won't be. Well, I think the same thing that you think is the real reason, if you're thinking. The sheriff is tanking in the polls. He's worried about his election. He needs some diversion, so we're the diversion. Although Patty's office was harassed with a search warrant a whole year ago by this same group. They took boxes of documents, which they have yet to fully return. And it's really harassment of his critics. He's been very open, like Nixon, that he has an enemies list. And this seemed like an opportune time to try to divert attention from his failures in terms of curbing, you know, gang membership by his deputies and all of the things that have been identified by the Fourth Estate. It's retaliation. It's harassment. It's always women. Although he did open an investigation to Max Huntsman, who is supposed to investigate him, this guy is really off the rails. And, you know, we have seen plenty of evidence of it. I'm not making this up.
So what happens now? Does the DA take this case?
No, the DA has said that he has no interest in this case. They looked at what was allegedly evidence. There wasn't any. And they're not even going to defend the search warrant in court if we challenged the elements of it. The DA actually has apologized several times, not the DA himself, but his staff, because they were not asked about this. They knew nothing about these raids, and they won't defend the search warrant in court.
So now what? So if they're not defending it, I think the sheriff said he wants to see if the state attorney general's office or the feds might be interested.
The only person in this whole issue that the feds are interested in is the sheriff himself. There's an open investigation into his behavior. But he's been trying for 4 years because this disaffected employee, when she was still at Metro, kept trying to get an investigation going. He's been trying because he wants to attack those who are attacking him. I don't think there's any other reason. I mean, Patty was a very strong chair of the Civilian Oversight Commission, a very good chair, and, you know, with a great reputation. You should see all the emails that allegedly people are getting. I can't get any emails anymore about, you know, what a great leader she is and always has been in the sexual assault and sexual harassment movement. This is pure harassment.
And in your mind, retaliation.
Oh, it's got to be retaliation because, you know, we even have something on the ballot in November so that the supervisors have something to say about an out-of-control person, I'm going to be kind, like the sheriff, because the damage that he's doing in L.A. County, I'm in Santa Monica, you know, I'm not being harassed every day by the sheriff, but you should look at the communities of color and ask them what they think, because he has an out-of-control department, and the only issue that can be brought up is by the Civilian Oversight Commission. That's why we established it.
And what you're referring to is a ballot question that would enable the Board of Supervisors to remove a sheriff if they find it necessary to do so.
Yes, but for very strictly delineated reasons that are egregious in terms of his behavior, all of which I can say Villanueva is guilty of at the moment.
All right. LA County Supervisor Sheila Kuehl, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, we reached out to the Sheriff's Department to respond to Supervisor Kuehl's allegations. The department referred us back to a statement it posted yesterday on its website, which reads in part, "The investigation has been shared with a federal agency and they continue to monitor. This remains an active investigation and we are unable to comment further at this time." This is day two of KCRW's Fall Pledge Drive, and it is a short and punchy drive. We are going to be done in just a few days. It's just a week long. So now's the time to get in and become a member or renew your membership by going online at kcrw.com/give. And you'll get not only the satisfaction of supporting the local news and the independent programming that you get only here on KCRW, including the incredible music Anthony and Novena put on just before this show, which, you know, if you're a fan of KCRW, you are listening to that show as much as you can. And you're listening to the news that we produce here that you can't get anywhere else. And then we have late night music that we put on every day. This is really a unique radio station, and I've worked in a lot of different places, and this is truly the best place that I have ever worked. And it's just a wonderful community. And if you feel the same way I do about KCRW, and I bet you do, be a member. Renew your membership right now. We really do rely on you. We can't do it without you. And do it for people who can't do it, too. So lots of people listen who can't afford to be a member. People who can't afford, well, we just lift everybody up, and we're all part of one big community. It's really a positive thing to do, so go ahead and do it. KCRW.com/give and take advantage of all our wonderful thank you gifts there online. Okay, coming up, more teens are accidentally overdosing on fentanyl. Drugs like Adderall can be laced with this drug. There are ways to prevent an overdose, and we're going to talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A 15-year-old girl died this week at Bernstein High in Hollywood after taking a fentanyl-laced Percocet pill. Three more students who took the same pills were hospitalized. And this morning, LA police detained two suspects whom they believe are selling the drugs. Fentanyl is a growing problem here in Los Angeles and across the country. More than 1,100 teens in the U.S. died from an accidental fentanyl overdose last year. Twice as many as 3 years ago. We're going to talk about the ways we can try to prevent these deaths now with Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. Welcome back to Press Play.
Glad to be with you again.
Well, it is a very sad and sober topic, and I guess the teens aren't looking for fentanyl necessarily. What drugs are they looking for most commonly?
Usually they're looking for pills like Ativan, which is an anti-anxiety drug, or maybe Adderall, which is taken for ADHD. And sometimes they might be looking for a lower strength opioid like Vicodin or Percocet. But the problem is that the cartels that make fentanyl have the very same pill press machines as the pharmaceutical industry, and they can make fentanyl look like anything. And that's why we're seeing more of these really terrible tragedies around the country of kids losing their lives.
And you can't tell the difference between a pill that is made legitimately and one made by a cartel?
It's remarkable how similar they look. And I mean, I work in this trade, and eyeballing it, I can't do it. If you have the facility to grind out a pill and mix it with a fluid and dip in a fentanyl test strip, then you can. But most people are not going to have that facility. And also, they're not even going to know it's a risk.
Yeah. Well, these kids that I was just talking about went to a park, I guess, to get them from a drug dealer. But you can get them online, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that's really accelerated this process is on, whether it's Snapchat or Etsy or many other sites, you have both access. You can order them and that you can do that in ways that, your parents, your teachers don't know about. But second is that those are channels to spread misinformation and disinformation about the risk level, which is in the interest of the sellers. They want people to think these drugs are perfectly safe and encourage them to use them. And they can pump that info right into kids' heads.
Why would drug dealers or drug manufacturers, cartels, whatever, why would they want to put fentanyl in these drugs?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I guess an analogy people would understand is, why does anybody make a tobacco cigarette when a third of people or half the people use that product will die? And it's that they're very profitable up till the time that they do die. So fentanyl is very, very, very cheap to make, 1% of the price of heroin. So if you're a trafficker and you are immoral, and I think by definition they are, you can say, some people are going to die immediately from this product, some people are going to die in a year, but it's addictive and they will buy it and they will be good customers up to that moment. And so we will accept that death because we're going to still make a lot of money.
Wow. What about if you get drugs legitimately? Should you worry that perhaps the prescription you get filled at your local pharmacist could be tainted with fentanyl?
There's no reason to worry about that. The system of fentanyl management in the United States within our pharmacies and hospitals is, in fact, very, very good. And in fact, fentanyl, by the way, is an incredibly useful drug when used properly, like in anesthesia and surgery and sometimes in hospice care. So there's nothing wrong with it when people know what they're doing. All this stuff is coming from entirely outside the healthcare system, for that matter, almost entirely from outside the United States.
Okay, so what can teenagers do to try to protect themselves if they do want to take these drugs, and or if they take them accidentally and there is an accidental overdose? What can they do?
So there's multiple strategies we can take, and I think we should think about what teens can do, but also what their parents can do and teachers can do, and so on. So it's when you're dealing with people who are very, say, well-established heroin users and you want to protect them from fentanyl overdose, you can say, well, we'll give them all naloxone, right? But you can't really give every kid in the United States naloxone. That's not plausible. There's too many of them. But what you can do is ensure all the places where there are lots of kids and kids hang out, including places where they use drugs, has naloxone in the same sense that they all have a fire extinguisher. So every school should have naloxone. Every community center where kids hang out should have it.
And describe how that would be administered.
Yeah, sure. So naloxone is, fentanyl is an opioid, and naloxone is a medication that's called an opioid antagonist. What that is when it's administered, which is usually done by just spraying it up the person's nose, it dislodges the opioid from the receptor in the brain where it binds. And why is that good? Because while that opioid is bound on there, it's stopping the person from breathing. And then naloxone will usually fairly quickly restore the person's breathing, and that stops them from dying because it's the lack of oxygen that mm-hmm. makes fentanyl fatal. So we want to have that in all the places like where kids hang out, and you know that's libraries, that's schools, that's clubs. We would want scout troop leaders to know about it. And for kids who are older, old enough to say go to a bar, a club, a place like that, they should all have that too. Second, I mentioned fentanyl strips. Teaching kids about those can be useful. Again, it's hard to cover the entire youth population, so it's not that will make a huge difference, but perhaps for some kids, they'll want to do that. But then there's also just a big role for prevention. Parents need to talk to their kids about this. And it's really hard, and I know this because I am a parent of teenagers, is that people are parenting now were exposed to a lot of drug war hysteria when they were kids. And so they're often kind of cynical about, look, I don't want to sound like, a 1980s.
Like Nancy Reagan, right.
Yeah. Blue Wrench Mom or something. Yeah, because we were told one pill can kill. And that was kind of extreme and hysterical at the time. Unfortunately, it's not extreme anymore. So you have to tell your kids about this, not because you're trying to scare them, but because you love them. Mm-hmm. And so we all have to be candid and take that role and say, it could be a dear friend of yours who gives you a pill, or someone you really like on Instagram who you think you trust. And yet it can end your life. And I don't want your life to end because I love you and you don't want your life to end. So, please don't do this. And also please, if you get pills from a strange source, please don't give them to anyone else either, because that's what most of these cases are like. And it's awful that this is the world we're in, but you have to give kids the good information.
Can you get these testing strips easily?
Well, the federal government, the Biden administration, decided that it's okay to use federal resources to fund them. So they're more available now than they have been anywhere else, usually from community organizations. So, some pharmacies may carry them. I expect that's actually pretty rare. Probably the best place to look would be through harm reduction organizations, would be the most likely place, or maybe a county health department, depending where you live.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine this might be a touchy subject, because if this is quote unquote normalized in schools, if they're teaching, about drugs, they don't want to, appear to be endorsing drug use by saying, well, you should always carry around some Narcan and a test strip.
Yeah, I guess I think of it this way, every school has a fire extinguisher in it, and we don't take that as an endorsement of fire. And so, they should all have naloxone. Not because we're endorsing drug use, but because, we don't want anybody to die. Mm-hmm. And we just have to learn to think of that way. And I can understand, I understand it's uncomfortable. I'm a parent and so on, but we have, deaths among kids have more than doubled in the past 2 years. Nationally, we're at over 100,000 deaths a year. We're going to have to get comfortable with some things that we were uncomfortable with before.
Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. Keith, thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
Just taking a little bit of a break to ask you to support your public radio station, KCRW, during our fall fundraiser. We're at kcrw.com/join. And it costs some money to provide you with local information that you have grown to rely on, you look forward to, hopefully, Press Play, Greater LA, and other shows that we produce here at the station. But, it's not free. It costs money to produce these things. And that's where you come in. So members have supported our efforts in the past, and now we're asking you to join them and help us as well. KCRW.com/give. We have tons of great thank you gifts there. at the website. You can check out our brand new merch with the new logo. It's super cute. It's these two little dogs, these two kind of plump dogs that I talked about earlier with Novena and Anthony. Check it out, kcrw.com/join. Renew your membership, please. We really do rely on you. We need you. You are the public in our public radio experiment here, an experiment that I will say has been going pretty well because we're still here. kcrw.com/give. It's all because of you, and thank you. Coming up, we will have your weekend movie reviews, including a new documentary about David Bowie.
I was really into learning about how, you know, he goes to Berlin to try to invent a new music, and then he renounces his complicated music because he wants to make simple music, and then he renounces making simple music.
Movie reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It is Thursday, and here again to review this week's new movie releases are Amy Nicholson, host of the podcast Unspooled, and a reviewer for the New York Times. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
And Carlos Aguilar. He reviews films for the LA Times and for The Wrap. Welcome back, Carlos.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. First up, we have a murder mystery. It's called See How They Run.
Victim's name is Leo Kopernik, sir. Seems he was killed in the costume store. And then he was deposited here. Staged, so to speak. Sorry, sir.
Okay, that's Saoirse Ronan and Sam Rockwell as investigators alongside a really star-studded cast. David Oyelowo is in this one. It's a whodunit. It kind of feels like Hercule Poirot, something like that. Amy, tell us more.
This movie is just a delight. I'm very happy to talk about it. It is riffing off this like very famous play that's been taking place in London since 1952. It's a production written by Agatha Christie called The Mousetrap. And it has been running in London for 70 years. And the reason it's a little bit unknown here is because Agatha Christie made this deal when the play went up in 1952. She said, you cannot make this into a movie until the run of this play is over. But it is about a movie producer who shows up and tries to turn this play into a film in 1953. It's a completely fictional murder that takes place in the back setting of this production. And the director is played by Adrian Brody, and he doesn't want to do this play. He thinks it's kind of stagey. He thinks all murder mysteries are the same. And he, of course, immediately gets killed at the very, very beginning of this play in a really hilarious murder that is just like, it's a little bit funny and it's a little bit Wile E. Coyote. And that's just kind of like the energy of this whole movie. Like it's scary when it needs to be. It's goofy when it needs to be. And it's just having fun with the idea of, can you make a fun murder mystery caper when everybody feels like they knows all of the surprises? But it's just so fun. Sam Rockwell and Saoirse Ronan, who you heard, they are like the two investigators of this. She's really naive. She just wants to arrest everybody on site. David Oyelowo plays this like very snobby playwright who wants to kind of cling to tradition as he adapts this into a film. And so he and Adrian Brody's character are just having all of these fights in the background of the movie. But it's just absolutely fun. This is just the sort of colorful, old-fashioned delight that I'm just happy to see.
And there's a murder mystery thrown in to boot. So we'd find out who did it, I guess, at the end.
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay, leave it at that. Carlos, what did you think?
Yeah, I agree with Amy. I was sort of shocked at how much I enjoyed this. It didn't seem like much on paper. I feel like watching it, I was constantly thinking of Wes Anderson. It feels kind of like that type of movie with, you know, a big ensemble cast and sort of like witty and, you know, very well produced set design and sort of, you know, kind of a whimsical, even though the subject matter is like a murder mystery. But I did enjoy Sam Rockwell and Saoirse Ronan's banter. The puns and the sort of play on words and the sort of refutal of all the tropes. There's a moment in which, you know, a character talks about flashbacks and we immediately go into a flashback. And it just moments like that that feel like they will play off as sort of obvious. They really work here and make you sort of like chuckle and smile throughout this story. I think that it never really sells itself as something other than what it is. And I think that that's very smart. And that's what makes it sort of enjoyable, because you're going in for the ride of like finding out who is the murderer. And then everything is so well put together as a meta puzzle that you kind of fall for it.
Oh, yay. A delightful film for a change. How lovely. See How They Run is in theaters in wide release today. Next up, The Woman King. Amy, you saw this one. It stars Viola Davis as a general commanding an all-female warrior unit in 19th century West Africa.
They will not stop until the whole of Africa is theirs. We must fight back for our people.
Aniska. You're asking me to take them to war.
War. Some things are worth fighting for.
Okay, Amy, tell us more. Is this based on a true story?
This is. This is definitely inspired by a true story. It takes some creative liberties, but it's just a very, very big, gorgeous, and I found ultimately emotional action film directed by Gina Prince-Bythewood, a director who I just love a lot. I've been following her career so closely since she did Love and Basketball. The setting here is that you're in this West African kingdom called Dahomey in the 1800s. And John Boyega plays this real king, King Gezu, who is dealing with a really tricky part of the European slave trade, where his kingdom and the kingdoms around him are actually participating in the slave trade. They're making money by kidnapping each other's people from each other's kingdoms and selling them to the Europeans. And Boyega's king is sort of almost a progressive. He considers himself at least a mild progressive, because his advancement is he's at least not selling his own people to the Europeans. He's just selling other people's people. And this broad stroke of history is definitely true. And it is also true that, like, the Dahomey, one of the reasons they're most famous still today is that they had an army of female soldiers called the Agoji. The general is played by Viola Davis, but the story itself is about this teenage girl who's played by Thusu Mbedu, and she's just incredible. She trains to join the Agoji, so it's like a training story about her, because her family has given her away to the king as a punishment. What I like about this film is that it's just a movie that really takes female strength as a given. You just immediately sink into this worldview, and that really, really worked on me. Watching it, I felt kind of the struggle with my cynicism that, like, the real story of this king's reign in this period isn't as uplifting as this movie itself is. But to the film's credit, like, Boyega kind of, he's able to both enter the movie as a character who's, like, larger than life, but they also let him beam a little morally murky. There's this court intrigue stuff that's happening in the background with, like, his many wives, his trusted eunuch, and the wife's costuming is so fun. It's just, it's like almost pop star costuming. And I feel like it signals almost like what the film itself is kind of saying. You know, this isn't quite historically accurate, but wouldn't it be great if it was? Wouldn't it just be great if the story was true? Yeah.
Okay. The Woman King is in theaters in wide release. Moving on to The Silent Twins. This stars Letitia Wright from the Black Panther films.
It spoke to me, and then it was just less and less, you know?
If there's something you want to communicate, you best say it now.
Jennifer, Joel, how would you describe your personalities?
I think you might be a bad influence on each other. It might be an idea to split you up for a while.
Okay, Carlos, this is based on a true story about twins in the UK. They were named June and Jennifer Gibbons, and they didn't speak much. They spoke to one another, and eventually they were institutionalized in a psychiatric hospital. Tell us more about this story.
Yeah, so this, as you mentioned, is based on the true story of these two sisters, which then became a book, and now it's a fiction film from the Polish director Agnieszka Smaczyńska. She's the director of The Lure, which was a film that I really love a few years back, which was a Polish mermaid musical, which was also a horror film. And now she's bringing that sort of unique perspective to this story. The twins in real life were avid writers, and they would write poems and stories and, you know, fictions. And so she and the writer have turned these sort of writings into stop motion sequences and music and numbers that sort of underscore the real life drama of the two sisters that, you know, are sort of misunderstood and, you know, taken into the mental health system without really knowing what affected them. And so the point of view is very unique because, you know, the tone switches between these fantastical, you know, segments and, you know, the sort of torture existences that the two sisters live, you know, in which they love each other, but at the same time, they're always competing and sort of trying to one-up each other in the most terrifying and dangerous ways, whether it means, you know, see who can become a mother first and who can, you know, find love first. And so I think that for some people, the, you know, the mixed tone might be difficult to engage with, but I find that, you know, using the writings to create lyrics for musical numbers or to create these sections is a very unique and interesting way of approaching a story that could be, you know, told in a documentary or in a sort of more traditional format. So I found very sort of fitting for a story like this.
Amy, what did you think?
Yeah, I really like the way that Agnieszka handles this. You know, she tells this story in a way that is, you're fanciful. You have like your felt puppets getting animated in stop motion style, but she doesn't allow anything in the movie to become too cute or too pat. She shows us the outside world and how some people in that community think of them as freaks. She shows them in their own house and how they're thought of as like very selfish by their older sister, you know, who's just sort of exhausted by their two-person psychodrama hijacking the entire family. You know, Letitia Wright is probably the bigger star in here, but Tamara Lawrence, she comes from British theater. She's been doing a lot of theater in the National Theater, and she's also just absolutely excellent. And they play off each other really well.
Okay, The Silent Twins is in theaters beginning today. Okay, last up, something that looks really exciting, or at least I'm excited about it, a documentary about David Bowie. It's called Moon Age Daydream.
Are you there, David?
You're aware of a deeper existence.
Are you there, David? Are you there, David?
Maybe a temporary reassurance that indeed there is no beginning, no end. And you find yourself struggling to comprehend a deep mystery.
Ooh, okay, so there is David Bowie actually narrating this documentary about himself. Carlos, let's begin with you. This is directed by Brett Morgan. This was actually approved by the Bowie estate. So tell us more about this movie, Moon Age Daydream.
Yeah, I found this very riveting in the sense that it avoids all the familiar trappings of biographical documentaries. You know, when you have people that knew the person and, you know, you have talking heads, you know, describing anecdotes or why this person was special or not. And then you have, you know, a little footage here. These sort of like, you know, sidesteps all of that and just goes for a very experiential cinematic experience that feels like a cosmic dance between, you know, Bowie's music and, you know, narrated by him in, you know, interviews and whatnot. And so you don't have like a precise timeline. You sort of just dropped into the music and sort of you build, you know, this evolution of this artist through his own narration. You know, he talks about specific ages in his life and, you know, what happened at those ages and the different artistic forms that he was trying out and how he tried to evolve his musical language. And in between, there are these moments of, you know, reflection, you know, in which Bowie feels really like a philosopher talking about life and the meaning of it all. And so you really enrapture in the whole experience, which I think it's a really, you know, an appropriate way of making a biographical documentary about him. So like without, you know, using the traditional elements and really making for something sensorial that, you know, fits within what this director, Brett Morgan, has done in the past. He made a documentary about Kurt Cobain called Montage of Heck, which was also sort of like, you know, taking all of these ideas and reflections of the artists and sort of building something out of them in a way that feels unique and engrossing.
Amy, what did you think? How did it feel to be in this movie?
I mean, you're definitely plunged into it. I mean, this film is, you know, promoting itself as something you should see on IMAX, which is how I saw it. And it's the first time I've seen an IMAX film where the footage itself isn't designed to be like flawless or beautiful. You know, it's built on old film stock. You know, it's grainy, it's old, it's definitely not IMAX quality, but it's designed to overwhelm you. You know, to have a big screen that you fill with Bowies, you know, like one Bowie, two Bowies, three Bowies, lots of Bowies, you know, singing at you. As somebody who came to Bowie only post Labyrinth, I was really into learning about how, you know, he goes to Berlin to try to invent a new music. And then he renounces his complicated music because he wants to make simple music. And then he renounces making simple music because he just wants to keep challenging himself and challenging itself. And it really just... it plays out almost more like a collapsing of time. You know, it starts with Bowie talking about like the limits of even understanding time at the beginning. And then the film itself, like he might be 22 in one frame, 45 in the next frame, with all of this kind of visual splinter to pick from. The one thing that kind of irritated me is towards the end, it tends to repeat a lot of the same footage that was really impressive before. It just felt like wasteful, like, oh, there's so much Bowie to pick from. Why am I watching this again? But that was the only period where I ever got really restless.
Hmm. I would think that would be just an embarrassment of riches.
Exactly. So I'm like, there was like three or four different scenes he kept showing and fairly long. And I'm like, why are we back here? Why are we here? There's so much. Yeah.
There's so much. There is so much. Okay. Well, it's nice to go back and be with Bowie now. Nice to have him back, I think.
You will get your fill of Bowie watching this film.
Amy Nicholson hosts the podcast Unspooled and reviews films for the New York Times. Carlos Aguilar reviews films for the LA Times and The Wrap. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, you are listening to KCRW during our fall pledge drive. It's the second day and it's going fast. It'll be over before you know it. We're just going to take a week this time around, really, really short, to get you to increase your membership, renew your membership, or become a brand new member. And we have lots of reasons why you would want to do that. Number one is the programming, of course. You're here for that, and that costs money to put on every day, especially local news programming. It's an expensive endeavor, but it is part of our service, our public service to you. And it's not just a service, it's not just news, it's also entertainment and the stuff of life that delights you. So hopefully our movie review segment every week does just that. If you love that, if you love the rest of the programming on KCRW, not just the news, but also the music and the national programming, please do your part to support it at kcrw.com/give. Lots of really, really great thank you gifts there on the website. So just go there and check it out. Check out our brand new swag. Pick up a bucket hat or some socks or a brand new tote bag. It's all there for you at kcrw.com/give. And thank you. Coming up, another homegrown KCRW favorite, Evan Kleiman. She's here with her weekly food segment on Press Play. Today, we're going to talk about sweet, sweet peppers, not just the red ones. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lunch?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Okay, not just pie, but lots of produce and delicious end of summer vegetables at the farmer's market, including a bumper crop of peppers. And maybe you're like me, you see a bunch of peppers and you're like, what do I do with all those? What are they? We're going to find out now with Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. She's going to tell us everything we need to know about sweet bell peppers. Just sweet bell peppers or all the peppers?
Well, I wanted to talk about sweet peppers. And the first thing I would say is make your mind think beyond the bell, that bell shape, the one that we now see with in the sleeve, you know, one red, one orange, one green.
Looking at you, Trader Joe's. Yes, I know what you're talking about.
Yes, but if you're at the farmer's market, you see the amazing variety of sweet peppers that come in at the end of the summer. And to me, the greatest is when I'm walking by a stand and I see these huge blocky peppers that are like double the length of a standard bell pepper, maybe even triple. And they might have a lot of colors all at once. You can see that they're ripening and they're shifting colors. So they might be red, but they might also have a little bit of chocolate or almost dark brown. And those are the ones to really celebrate this time of year.
All right. So I guess I need a little 101 on what exactly is a ripe sweet pepper, because they change colors as they ripen, right? So they go from green to red?
Most of the peppers that we see in the store that are sold green, red, orange, or yellow are separate varieties. It isn't that industrial farmers are waiting for the plants to turn. They're grown, they're bred to favor a certain color. But out in the wild... Mm-hmm. Out in the land of more biodiversity, there are so many varieties, but all of them will change from the initial color, which is usually green, to other colors. But for example, I grow one in my backyard. It's a Polish bell pepper. It's black. It's green inside, by the way, these black peppers, but then they ripen to become like a chocolate brown. And then they're a little less vegetal in flavor, and they're sweeter.
Mm. So when they're sweeter, what do you do with them that is different than you would do with a green bell pepper?
I love to do two things. One is roast them and slip off the skins and just lightly drizzle olive oil, a little salt, lemon juice, and maybe some basil over it, and just enjoy those with bruschetta. Another thing that I do that requires patience is to saute them very slowly in a good amount of olive oil until they become absolutely soft and yielding. And these you don't want to peel them. And then the peel gets little bits of char on it. And that, with some good bread to sop up the juices, is just fantastic. So one of my favorite recipes to make that really allows summer peppers to shine is cookbook author Patricia Wells' Maggie's Roasted Red Peppers. And it's a condiment, really, of sweet and spicy peppers, both braised in olive oil. And it's just fabulous. Mm. If you make it once, you'll never not have it during the summer months.
And you'll have a link to that on the website, kcrw.com, right?
Yes, as well as my recipes for frying them and making peeled roasted peppers.
Mm, that sounds so good. And because they are a fruit, are they ever made into pies or anything resembling dessert?
A fruit doesn't necessarily mean that something is sweet. It just means it has seeds and that it grows from a flower, as opposed to being a leaf, which some vegetables are leaves or roots or stems.
But you can make a tomato pie. We've talked about that.
Tomatoes are sweeter, and they also have all that water in them. They're more like, you know, have the texture more like a berry. They work in a pie. I don't think that a pepper would work so well in a pie. And let me just say, let me rant for a second here. That thing that everybody does of chopping up peppers, dicing raw peppers, and throwing them into stuff, and then keeping that salad or whatever around for days. Oh my goodness. Stop doing that.
Why?
Because the peppers turn so fast when you do that, it ruins the dish and you don't enjoy what the peppers have to offer you in terms of crunchiness or flavor. Mm. It's just a whole compromise situation. Not good.
Okay. So eat your peppers as soon as you make them, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Enjoy them immediately.
Enjoy them. Don't think of them as just a way to add color to your bland grain dish.
Okay, perfect. I like your rant. And if you want to hear more ranting, you can listen to your show that you normally rant. But what is on Good Food this week?
Well, we visit two beloved institutions, Tale of the Pup, which has been resurrected, and Irv's Burgers. We also talk to a lovely woman about Zambian wedding traditions. And Eric Kim from the New York Times comes by to encourage us to make kimchi at home.
Oh, I would like to know that. And it's cabbage and salt is part of it, right?
That's the very beginning part of it.
Very beginning, and it goes on and on. Okay, so check out all of that at kcrw.com. Evan Kleinman is host of Good Food, and you can listen Saturday mornings at 10 on the radio or anytime you want, wherever you get your podcasts. Evan, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline. Always so much fun.
Well, it is always so much fun to have Evan Kleinman on the show. I just love talking to her about food. She is a wealth of knowledge, and she has been doing this for many years on KCRW. She is certainly unique. You don't hear her anywhere else. That is reason enough to support this radio station at kcrw.com/join. Do it for Evan and all of the delicious, juicy morsels that she passes your way and inspires you at this hour. Oh, it's always when I'm most hungry that I love listening to her. But I love listening to her all the time because she's just so engaging and she always has something really interesting to tell us. And I always learn a lot, but not in a pedantic way. Anyway, enough of that. You know why you love her. You know why you love KCRW. So just do it. Become a member. Renew your membership. Pick up some of our cute, wonderful new swag. It's on the website for you to check out. Two little dogs. Even if you don't love dogs, you're going to love these guys. KCRW.com/join, 800-600-5279. If you call on the phone, you can leave a comment about how much you love Evan. Or you can also do it there when you contribute on the website. There's a place for you to put your comments. So do that now. KCRW.com/join. We are really running out of time. I know we always say that in the fundraiser, but this is a shorty this time around. So don't put it off. KCRW.com/join to become a member or renew your membership to your favorite radio station. And that does it for this week for Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hordzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, and Marcel Hutchins. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Amy Ta is our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney is our super managing producer. Our technical director, Mario Saavedra, Sue Margulies, also engineered this week. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for being a member. Thanks for supporting us at KCRW. I'll see you on Monday.